Abraham.
Baruch Adonai, Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kidshanu Mitzvata, Mitzvah Nilasa, Mitzvah Torah.
It's exhausting. I don't know if I'm on.
Maybe you're not on. Excuse me, you're not on yet.
Oh, was I supposed to turn that?
I knew that I was. You're on, yeah.
Is it on?
Yeah.
That was too much on. You know what? Because it's near there.
No, this is off.
Okay. Let me see. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Oh, no. I think it's too much. It's too much.
Look at the house. I don't know. The moment
you
cut that one off. And
hold this. Do you mind?
Yeah.
I'm going to cut you off.
Okay. All right. Well, good morning, everybody. It's been an exhausting few days for those of us who've been here for the last few days. So it's so gratifying to see people up and about. We're going to talk about a topic that I think is going to wake all of us up. A very different Martin Luther than the Luther that we studied for those of you who were here 2 weeks ago. And I was thinking before I start, if there are any of you who were not here 2 weeks ago, I am going to repeat a little of it just to get everyone up to speed. But if you would like the handout that I gave around 2 weeks ago, if you just leave me your name and email address, I'll send it to you electronically. Okay? All right. So, first of all, for those of you who weren't here, and I think most of you were here, actually, but for those who weren't, you know, why this topic? Why 3 weeks on Protestantism and the Jews? Last October, to be specific, Halloween 2017, marked the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's posting his 95 theses on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg in Germany. Now, I mentioned briefly 2 weeks ago that there are some contemporary Luther scholars who doubt whether historically this in fact happened. It's shocking to me. I'm not a Luther scholar, but I always thought this really happened. Luther did write the 95 theses. He did circulate them within a very short period of time. It led to his excommunication from the Roman Catholic Church. But that one event on Halloween 500 years ago, again, may never have occurred. In any case, at the time, very few people had ever heard of Martin Luther. But within less than 4 years, he had become a familiar and feared name in universities and courts throughout Europe, and his books were read everywhere. Now again, who was Martin Luther? A few lines, a few more information, things that I said last time, and maybe I'll add some others. But I want to talk about a little, you know, who was Luther, what were the 95 theses, what was the relationship between Protestants and Jews forged by the Protestant Reformation? And what led Luther to write his most infamous book, which we'll be looking at today? It's not a book. It's a long, very long treatise. What led him to write this treatise called On the Jews and Their Lies, which, again, we'll look at this morning. Luther, very briefly, in terms of his biography, was born in 1483. He was a peasant. He showed great intellectual promise as a youth, and he attended the University of Erfurt, where his father hoped that he would pursue a career in canon law. Instead, Luther immersed himself in theology and spiritual contemplation, and in 1505, he became a monk. 3 years later, he was appointed professor of theology at the recently founded Saxon University of Wittenberg. And for almost 10 years, as both an academic and as a friar, he built a solid reputation as a scholar. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, his focus was on the fall of humanity after Eve and then Adam ate what for Christians is the apple in the Garden of Eden. So his focus was on sin. You know, he wasn't the only Christian theologian who focused on sin. And the power of free will through which he thought human beings could seek their salvation. His scholarly work was of not only intellectual importance, but really of great personal importance to him. And his writings really changed his life. I mean, his ideas, as he was thinking them, came out on paper. You may remember, those of you who were here 2 weeks ago, it said that he published something at least once every 2 weeks. So he was, even though he was married and had children during this period, but he was an incredibly prolific scholar. And he finally found what he was looking for, which was acceptance by God, the promise of salvation, and this sense that despite humanity's total helplessness before God, that God is righteous, and therefore for him it didn't mean that God is angry at the sinfulness of humanity, but rather God is willing to make the sinner free of sin by the power of God's love freely bestowed on the true believer. Now, where we're going to get to this morning is to a very different Luther. By the 1540s, he had kind of given up on the notion that some sinful human beings were willing to work to overcome their sin. So whereas 2 weeks ago we looked at the writings of Luther and also of Calvin on Jews as people of the Hebrew Bible, whom he thought really would see the light and convert to Christianity, within the last few years of his life, he came to believe that that hope was futile, but he didn't walk away quietly. He wrote some of the most anti-Jewish, angry, virulent writings against Jews that exist to this day. One of the things that has happened within Protestant circles on this 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses has been Lutheran churches really acknowledging the anti-Judaism of Luther. You know, up until now, most Lutherans and the Lutheran church in general has glossed this over. And said, well, that's not really the real Luther. He was an old man. He was dying. This isn't really who Luther was. But I will say, throughout 2017, there was a real honest reckoning on the part of the church and on the part of individual Lutherans, especially in the United States and among many in Germany as well, basically saying, look, Luther taught many wonderful things. Our whole notion of salvation and God's grace wouldn't be possible were it not for Martin Luther. But Martin Luther was anti-Judaism. Again, we're not going to say anti-Semitic, because the term anti-Semitism doesn't arise until over 300 years after Martin Luther's death. Right? Anti-Semitism is a term first coined by a German racist named Wilhelm Marr in 1879 in Germany. Right? That's the whole idea that Jews are a race above and beyond all else, and that as a race, Jews are inferior. Martin Luther was not against Jews as a race. He didn't see them as a race. He saw them as a religious group who had once been the chosen people of God. But as you'll see today, he really felt that their rejection of the Messiah that God had sent to them had really left them not only in perpetual exile and in misery, but that in fact for him, they were no longer God's people. All right, so I don't want to go through everything I said 2 weeks ago, but let me just say, try to say two or three sentences on this, that one of his big arguments with the Roman Catholic Church was in the selling of indulgences. And I think it's hard to read Luther, and certainly impossible to read the 95 Theses, without seeing how front and center at Luther's anger at the Roman Catholic Church was this whole idea that you could buy your way into heaven. You know, the whole idea that, okay, you could do whatever you did in your life, you could go to a priest, you could confess, and then you could give some money to the church, and that would get you straight to purgatory. All right, and from there, you would get to go up to heaven. You know, purgatory is this sort of netherworld between heaven and hell. So if you gave the church money, you would not go to hell, which means you would never get to heaven, but instead you could be in purgatory and you'd have the fast track to heaven. And, you know, in the context of his time, not only was this revolutionary, but in fact the selling of indulgences was corrupt and did lead to a Catholic Reformation in response to the Protestant Reformation. And part of the response of Catholic reformers was to say this practice of selling indulgences has to go. So, you know, there's a sense in which the Protestant Reformation itself helped reform Roman Catholicism in a very positive way. I think Martin Luther would have liked to have gotten rid of the celibacy of priests altogether. That obviously never happened. But again, there were changes that were made to the Roman Catholic Church as a result of Martin Luther and all of his many writings. So for almost 30 years, Luther published an incredible number of books, pamphlets, sermons, and letters. And scholars have maintained that the Protestant Reformation was not the work of one man, because they say religious upheaval needs many people. But scholars agree, without Martin Luther, there would have been no Reformation. Now, in his early works, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, he denounced priesthood. And he maintained that the clergy's only role should be preaching the Word of God and encouraging Christians to read the Bible. Now, one of the things that the Roman Catholic Church espoused and still espouses today is that rather than read the Bible itself, Catholics should read Catholic interpretations of the Bible, not unlike Jews who read rabbinic commentaries of the Torah rather than reading the Torah itself. And so in his earlier works, that was a major concern of Luther. He really wanted Christians to go back and to read the Old Testament and the New Testament for themselves, which initially, as I said 2 weeks ago, led him to look favorably upon the Jews. Because the more he and other followers of his read the Old Testament, the more they came to appreciate the teachings of what we call the Torah, and they came to have a new respect for Jews as God's first chosen people. In fact, and this is the last thing I'll say about what I said 2 weeks ago, Luther in 1523, he didn't live that long. In 1523, he published an essay which we looked at 2 weeks ago called That Jesus Christ Was Born a Jew. And in that, among other things, not only did Luther say Jesus, in fact, was Jewish, something which was not obvious to most Christians at the time, but he also formally denounced the blood libel, this idea that Jews kill Christian children and use their blood for Jewish ritual purposes. It seems early on he felt sympathy towards Jews because he himself had been rejected by the Roman Catholic Church officially, and therefore he even wrote that Jews have a right to resist Catholic efforts to convert them. And yet, in this early essay, which we looked at 2 weeks ago, he went on to write that he hoped the Jews would come to see in his reformed Christianity the true faith of their fathers. He fully believed that Jews would see that Jesus was the Messiah that God had sent to them and to the world. But when Jews didn't see what Luther wanted them to see, and didn't convert to Christianity, he completely turned against them. And in 1543, 3 years before his death, Luther published an anti-Jewish text entitled On the Jews and Their Lies, which became, unfortunately, really his most infamous writings, and in many ways overshadowed a lot of what he had written before. 400 years after the death of Martin Luther, Hitler himself used anti-Jewish slanders that originated in Luther's essays. That is, he quoted from On the Jews and Their Lies, even if he didn't give Martin Luther credit. As historian Daniel Goldhagen has written, the underlying cultural modern definition of the Jew was composed of three notions: that the Jew was different from the German, that he was a binary opposite of the German, and that he was not just benignly different, but malevolent and corrosive. As historian James Carroll writes in his book, Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, all these elements of Jew hatred were present throughout German Christianity, but they became solidified in German Christianity and among Germans themselves after the diatribes of Martin Luther. Indeed, as Carroll continues to write, by 1543, Luther's growing disenchantment with Jews really festered into what Carroll calls a venomous hatred, and you're going to see this morning for yourself. As another scholar of the 20th century, Heiko Obermann, has said, the basis of Luther's anti-Judaism was the conviction that ever since Christ's appearance on earth, the Jews have had no more future as Jews. So Luther's hatred of Jews went from theological hatred to really political hatred. So he began with a theology, you know, this theology that the Jews were first selected by God, but basically they blew it when they rejected Jesus as the Messiah whom God had sent. But somewhere along the line, in the early 1540s, he took that theological hatred and made it a political hatred as well. Because since Jews were involved in finance, associated with monies conducted, that were collected for indulgences for the Pope, he therefore began to see that maybe Jews were the ones who were responsible for the selling of indulgences because they were actually getting financial gain out of it. So for him then, Jews became the embodiment of the enemy, the theological enemy and the political enemy. And his goal was to make Germany Judenrein, term used by the Nazis 400 years later. Right? He wanted to make Germany free of Jews, which is a huge jump from his early appreciation of Jews as people of the book to then seeing the Jews as the enemy, the theological and political enemy, and wanting them to get out of Germany. As he writes, and I'm quoting from Luther, they are for us a heavy burden, the calamity of our being. They are a pest in the midst of our lands. So having said that, I did a handout for today. It's not all that cheery a handout, but what can you do? There you are. I think hopefully I have enough. And these are actually excerpts from... This handout includes four excerpts. Each of them are from another treatise. So they are from the four treatises that Luther wrote. Can you see this? Okay, we should have almost enough. I hope so. Right?
Make sure.
What?
Make sure.
Yeah. Could be 50.
How is this theological anti-Judaism different from that of the Roman Catholic Church? Was it different?
Yeah. Is it different? Okay, that's a good question. So Shira's question is, how is the theological anti-Judaism of Luther different from the theological anti-Judaism of the Church? So that's a good question. I really have to think about that. I don't know. When I think of how the anti-Judaism of the Roman Catholic Church was manifest in the Middle Ages, I think about the Crusaders. I think about acts of violence. I think about institutional hatred. Luther didn't have the kind of political power, nor did he have the kind of theological power that the popes did. And maybe because of that, the words that he writes are much more personal against the Jews. That is, you know, if you were to read some of the great church fathers who also taught anti-Judaism, they did it under the veneer, or they made it sound more scholarly. They weren't talking in the first person. They weren't saying things like we should throw the Jews out of their lands. The Crusaders said that, but not people like Thomas Aquinas. So I think you have this anti-Jewish sentiment in the writings of not all of the popes, but some of the popes, certainly church fathers and interpreters up through the Middle Ages. But I don't know, you read this and you'll see. Like when I read people like Augustine and Aquinas and all those people, I get the feeling they really didn't know any Jews. And if they did, it was only Jewish scholars. But when you read Luther, he's like a lover scorned. You know, it's written in a much more personal way, as if he really did hope that the Jews would become Christians, and when he was spurned by them, he takes it out on them in a very vindictive way. Now, again, he didn't have the power then to send Christian armies in to kill them. So was he envisioning something more like pogroms? Yeah, I think he was. And at the end of the day, maybe that's worse, because he wasn't saying within a certain time period you should do X, Y, and Z to the Jews. He was saying this is how we should behave towards them from now into the future, which is scary. And in fact, he became very influential, you know, especially after his day. All right, so let's look at this. So let me first, I have to tell you what this essay is, because it's an unusual title. So the first anti-Jewish essay he wrote was in 1538. And again, up until then, what he had written about Jews was largely hopeful and appreciative of their having been given the Torah. But in 1538, he wrote this treatise called Against the Sabbatarians. Now, the Sabbatarians in Luther's day referred to Christians who observed their Sabbath on the seventh day. Right? So they were, I don't know if they were like Seventh-day Adventists, but they did observe Saturday as their Sabbath. And Luther had heard from some so-called good friend of his, I mean, he called him a good friend of his, some guy by the name of Count Wolfgang Schlick of Falkenau. Count Falkenau came to him, according to Luther. Again, I have no idea if this is historically true, but in the preface to this treatise, Luther tells us that this good friend of his came to him and told him about the so-called Judaizing activities among Christians in Moravia. That is, this count came and told Luther that these Sabbatarians were actually were going to synagogues and were reading Jewish teachings, and he was afraid that they, by observing the Sabbath, were already taking the first step towards becoming Jews. And that motivated him to theoretically write an essay against them. But in reality, as 20th century scholars have shown, the arguments that Luther makes in this essay don't mesh with what we know of 16th century Seventh-day Sabbath Christian groups. Right? So it took a few hundred years for scholars to figure out that maybe Luther was not writing against the Sabbatarians at all. But, they have pointed out, his description in this essay does portray a successful proselytizing effort on the part of Jews directed at Christians. Now, why he doesn't just say that this is actually directed at Jews who are proselytizing among Christians, I have no idea. Certainly there cannot have been a lot of Jews who were proselytizing among Christians, because it was rare and it was illegal, right? But what scholars then have concluded is that maybe Luther's Sabbatarians are best understood, and here I quote from remarks made by two Luther scholars, Chrissy Sterna and her husband Brooke Schramm, who have written about this, and they wrote especially, you know, in the last year or so about this. They have said that perhaps Luther's Sabbatarians are best understood as, quote, a bogeyman that grew out of the Christian fear that Jews would make proselytes of Christians. In other words, this is sort of the beginning of his seeing Jews at every turn, you know, and really reflects his fear that Jews, even though it was against the law, were going to begin to proselytize more and try to convert Christians to Judaism. So in other words, we're going to look at this and read from this, but think of this treatise as directed not against Christians, but against Jews. And you'll see there is one part in one of the first lines where he even addresses Jews. Okay, so who's reading this today? Ellen, you're not reading today? Wait, you're reading again?
Let's try.
She's our reader. Let's try.
Okay. Let's see if it works.
We're going to see if it works.
The official reader. She's the reader every week?
She is.
Yes,
a
designated reader.
Oh, I have to give you a... The Jewish people have become very stubborn because of their rabbis. As a result, they are difficult to win over. Even when one persuades them out of Scripture, they retreat from the Scripture to their rabbis and declare that they must believe them. Dear Jew, tell me which sin it is. What is the sin that prompts God to be angry with you so long and to withhold his Messiah? Even if the Jews could name the sin, they would still be caught in their lie. God's word still stamps them as liars, since he assures them that he will never fail because of their sins and his promise to send the Messiah and to preserve the throne of David forever. It follows incontestably that one of the following two things must be true.
Yeah, typo, obviously.
Either the Messiah must have come 1,500 years ago, or God must have lied. May God forgive me for speaking so irreverently, and has not kept his promise. Since these 1,500 years of exile do not humble the Jews or bring them to awareness, you may with a good conscience despair of them. For it is impossible that God would leave his people, if they truly were his people, without confident prophecy so long. He never did this before, because God, 1,500 years, has let them live on and on in exile without any word or prophecy. It is evident that he has forsaken them, that they can no longer be God's people, and the true Lord, the Messiah, must have come 1,500 years ago.
Okay, so you can see there are a number of typographical errors here, but hopefully you can get his main point. Is this too loud?
No.
Okay, so what is the main point he's trying to make here? Jews are no longer God's chosen people. Why? Yeah?
The fact that the Messiah hasn't come is
in
saying that God's turned his back up.
Well, the Messiah did come, right? The Messiah came 1,500 years ago, as he continues to say.
Meaning Jesus
was the Messiah. He was a Jew. It was obvious, at least for Luther, that that's who the Jews have been waiting for. And?
Because they were an exile.
What?
They're in exile.
Right,
they're in exile. I'm trying to get this
out. It's too loud. I can talk you into it, but it's so loud. Okay. Right, so they're in exile. And he's now going on to really say, I think something new, which he's saying Jews were in exile in other periods. You know, they were in exile when Solomon's temple was destroyed. They went into exile. Some of them went into exile after the destruction of the second temple. But God always seemed to be with them. But basically, God doesn't seem to be sending the prophets anymore. God isn't speaking out to them and comforting them. So therefore, God must really be angry at them now. You know, and therefore he's saying if God is angry at them, God is angry at them for a reason. Plus, God always keeps God's promises. God promised the people that he would send them the Messiah. And he's saying, like, what's their story? He sent them the person they were looking for. Right, he sent them someone who was a descendant of King David, who was born in Jerusalem, and he doesn't understand at this point in his life why Jews would have rejected Jesus, or what he calls Christ as our King and our Lord. And because of that, he's saying that Jews are now no longer part of this covenantal relationship. Now, he'll go on. You know, we're going to look at these later essays, and you'll see he gets angrier and angrier, and his condemnation of Jews even stronger. But even at this point, most of the Christian commentators on Hebrew scriptures, up until this point, following the lead of St. Augustine over 1,500 years before, said that even though Jews blew it when they rejected Jesus as the Messiah that God had sent,
that doesn't mean that God no longer had a special relationship with the Jewish people. I mean, most of the Christian commentators continue to believe that Jews were still God's people, even though God had now chosen a new people, but that Jews had a reason to live. Okay, this is Christian theology, but not Martin Luther. So another, you know, not every church father agreed with this. Some did say they are the devil's gateway. That was Tertullian way back. But most of them said, no, the fact that Jews aren't suffering and are in exile shows that God does act in history and that God's always present. So Luther is saying the suffering of the Jews shows that God is not present there for them. But in fact, most Christian scholars up until that point would have said, no, it shows that God is acting in history because their suffering is proof of God's judgment. God wants to show the world what happens when you don't recognize the promises of God. And therefore, Jews wandering, Jews being in exile, are actually signs of the existence of God and God's activity throughout history. But Catholic theologians would go on to say, Jewish suffering is also proof of God's mercy. Because if Jews basically see the light and convert to Christianity, then they in fact can attain salvation. So the suffering and the wandering of Jews in the eyes of most Catholic theologians prior to Luther, and even some today, although you don't hear it as much, is that God does keep God's promises. But that the promise was that God was going to send the Messiah. Jews rejected Jesus as the Messiah. And therefore, God is still with them in their suffering. It's God's judgment against them. But that God will also be merciful to them should they convert to Christianity. Luther is saying, no, they're not God's chosen people anymore. They were God's chosen people. They would have continued to be God's chosen people. But they aren't. Right, that's what I think he's pretty much saying in this early essay.
Question over there.
Hmm? Oh,
what is it? Okay. When you say the suffering of the Jews, what is their suffering that's different than suffering of Christians?
During the Middle Ages?
Yeah. I mean, there was poverty for everybody. There was disease for everybody. So when the theologians were going, the suffering of the Jews, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, how is it worse, especially in the middle of the Middle Ages, than it is? I mean, it'll only get worse as the Middle Ages goes on. And of course, Luther's at the end of the Middle Ages, almost the early modern era. So I think the suffering of the Jews would include, in Christian countries, things like a special Jew tax. So even though everybody other than the lords were poor, Jews were even more poor, because they had a special tax that they had to pay. And when they couldn't pay that tax, they were simply thrown out of the countries in which they lived. For example, Jews were expelled from England in 1290 only because they'd been taxed to death. And since they couldn't pay the Jew tax anymore, they were thrown out, not to be formally readmitted until 1664. Literally, Jews were thrown out of France in 1315, largely for economic reasons as well. But it was that this undue burden had been put upon them. So it's interesting when you say that, because I think it was largely economic. The hatred of Jews was largely economic in terms of their suffering. There also was the killing of Jews, both by the Crusaders and by ordinary people. You know, we have local riotings that would go from city to city. So in terms of the Crusaders, the First Crusade was okay. I mean, the First Crusade did not target Jews. But by the time you get to the Second Crusade, you have the idea of these Crusaders traveling to the Holy Land to throw the Muslims out of Jerusalem. And while they were going through Europe, they thought, you know, why don't we also kill the first enemy of the Christians, namely the Jews? And so untold tens of thousands of Jews lost their lives in some of the Crusades, again, especially the Second Crusade. I recently read, this book that came out about 3-4 years ago on William of Norwich. I don't know if you remember William of Norwich, but I'll say one thing about him. Anyway, in this book, it goes on to talk about the fact that one reason why the Crusaders were so bloodthirsty is that they themselves were poor.
they couldn't pay back the lords who had lent them the money to go on the Crusades, and that sort of led them to vent their anger. But the religious persecution of Jews in the Middle Ages was also there, the religious hatred of Jews. And that really, it's hard to know exactly when it begins, but it does get worse as the Middle Ages goes on. And there's an event that takes place in 1144 in England, which leads to an outburst of anti-Judaism that has continued up until this day. And that has to do with the famous blood libel that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So in 1144, there was a Christian boy, I think he was around, I can't remember now, 13, 14 years old. He was an apprentice, I think to a cobbler. He actually was from a fairly well-to-do family. And he was found dead in the town of Norwich. And basically nobody cared that much, and the story was pretty much forgotten. But the local church, Roman Catholic Church in Norwich, decided that if they made this murdered boy a saint, that it would be a way of getting tourists to come to Norwich. Apparently there were, and again, I've learned all this, I mean, I've known about William of Norwich for over 30 years, but I didn't know a lot of the filler until I read this new book that came out a few years ago. So basically, it also was economically motivated, that there were other cathedrals in the area that attracted tourists because they had either relics of saints or they had a holy local person. So the idea of the local, of the cathedral in Norwich was to try to make William a saint. So even though the community didn't care much about him, anyway, his elevation to sainthood never went anywhere. But the thing that did succeed was this charge leveled against one of the most prominent Jews in Norwich, that he, in fact, was the murderer, and that he had engineered the killing of young William. This took place right between Passover and Easter. That he had engineered the killing of William to use his blood, actually not for the making of matzah, which is how I originally had heard this charge, but it was for unspecified Jewish ritual use. In the end, it turns out that the community at Norwich weren't that moved by the story, but this blood libel spread throughout Europe in an alarmingly short period of time. In fact, it was this account, so scholars say, that led Jews to open their doors during the Passover Seder when we welcome in Elijah. That before that there was this welcoming of Elijah, but we didn't physically open the door. And the idea of opening the door for Christians to walk by and see that what was being conducted was a meal and not some kind of satanic ritual goes back to the murder of William of Norwich. So again, yeah, I agree that things were not good for almost everybody during the Middle Ages, but Jews did have particular suffering based both on their religion, but also on the economic role that they played. And you know, to get into Michael, you could do a whole thing on this. I mean, the fact that in Christian Europe, the usurers were Jews also led people not to like them that much. And that's because Catholics, the Roman Catholic Church said the Catholics could not lend money at interest. Jews didn't have that understanding of the biblical laws concerning usury. So most of the money lenders in medieval Europe were Jews, which probably exacerbated anti-Judaism of the Middle Ages, but certainly exacerbated it by the time you get to the 16th century, which is early modern Europe, with the rise of modern capitalism. Because once modern capitalism arises, a large number of Jews who had formerly been moneylenders or from moneylending families became interested in business. And as a result, you had people hostile to Judaism. One guy that comes to mind is the German scholar Werner Zumbart, who writes this work in the 16th century called How the Jews Invented Capitalism. And he didn't mean that as a compliment. And so those kinds of charges really happen as a result of anti-Jewish sentiment during the Middle Ages with the association of Jews and money. I would say the association of Jews and money becomes more prominent after the development of capitalism, but it's still something that really begins during the Middle Ages. Yeah.
Is the children's story book, The Golem, Is that about the blood libel?
No. That's more about this figure coming to life, but it's not. No, and that was a story told by Jews themselves. I mean, the golem is a figure in the Jewish imagination, but the blood libel is really a Christian image. Although you may know that the blood libel today, I don't know if you know this with the blood libel. So the last known instance of Christians killing Jews because of the blood libel charge was in 1946 in Kielce, Poland, when a number of Holocaust survivors actually decided to return to their hometown of Kielce. And that year, right between Passover and Easter, there was what we can only call a pogrom. Local residents of Kielce, including those who had taken over the homes of those Jews who had been sent to the camps and didn't want to give them back, basically rose up against the Jewish population and killed most of the Jews of Kielce. On the other hand, it seems that the blood libel charge is alive and well, and you might have seen on the public broadcasting system part of this series that was on Al Jazeera television in the early 2000s, where amazingly this blood libel charge was transformed into a blood libel charge that Jews killed Muslim children and used their blood for ritual purposes. I mean, this charge never had anything to do with Jews and Islam. But through this TV series, the idea was popularized that, in fact, the Jews are out to kill innocent Muslims. Yeah?
I was under the impression that the Jews also were not allowed to lend to other Jews at interest, but they could lend to non-Jews at interest.
That would make them even more hated, though, if that were true. Let's go on. Okay, Michael, you have a question?
You may have covered this earlier, but what was the light bulb that went off for Martin Luther that caused him to, at one point, be welcoming to the Jews or hoping they'll come back and then develop this deep hatred and resentment and the writings that we see? Was it a psychological change or was it always there?
Right. I think what led him to appreciate the Jews early on was actually going and reading the Old Testament. He had never read it before. You know, as a monk, he had read Christian interpretations of the Old Testament, but when he went back and read the Hebrew Scriptures, he couldn't believe how rich it was. Now, realize he still saw it through the lens of Christianity. So he saw the patriarchs and Moses as Christians. But he still thought, this is a wonderful text. And he really encouraged Christians to read for themselves the writings in the Torah. And he really did believe that God had chosen the Jewish people. So that's what led to this great appreciation. But for him, since it was obvious that these early founders of Judaism were actually Christians, that is, you know, had they lived long enough and Messiah had come, they would have converted to Christianity, it really took 30 years for him to, well, not quite 30, that's 15, 17, 27, 37. It took a little over 20 years for him to realize that his view of the Jews was very naive, that they were stubborn, that they listened to their rabbis too much, as he says, and that they had no intent. Right? He says it's several places, sure, not just as well. But that they were not going to convert to Christianity. And so that was the light bulb. It's the fact that these people are evil. And we're going to go on and see that. So in this first essay in 1538, he doesn't yet say that they're evil people, but he is saying that basically God isn't with them anymore. So that's like his first step. And then he just gets more and more worked up about it. That's the only way I can figure it. Now, there have been many psychological studies of Luther. And it may well be that a lot of this was psychological. I don't know. But in any case, it will lead him to write. Let's move on, because I want to make sure we have time. Oh, yeah, we don't have time.
I just want to say, in light of that, there are those who say that all exegesis is eisegesis. Mm-hmm. That exegesis is the word for commentary. But the exo is to take out, like Exodus, right? The exo, so exegesis, taking out of the text. Eisegesis, E-I-S-O, is reading into the text, putting yourself into the text. So there are those who claim that all exegesis is really eisegesis. There's no way to separate commentary from reading in your own life, your own. There is no real separation. So it may be, again, that the psychological and the scholarly, it's impossible to say, to draw that line. Let's go on.
Yeah. So the second text that he wrote, which was in 1541, I think, right? 1541, was a treatise called The New Preface to Ezekiel. So essentially, Luther wanted to do his own translation, German translation, of the entire Old Testament, and wanted to write a preface to the entire book, right? The entire Old Testament. I guess he just didn't have the time. Maybe he didn't have the interest. Because in terms of advancing his own theological agenda, I don't think it would have been that helpful to do a preface to the entire Hebrew Bible. But instead, he wrote a preface to Ezekiel. Now, in many ways, that was a brilliant choice. If you've read Ezekiel, you know Ezekiel? So Ezekiel has a lot of visions.
The vision of the dry bone. Yeah.
Right. I was going to say that I think all of his visions, he also has a vision of the chariot. But I think in terms of Luther, you know, what's most useful is Ezekiel 38 and this vision of the dry bones. Because Ezekiel has this vision that there are the dry bones, and he actually tells us that the dry bones are the people of Israel who have been brought into exile, and that a descendant of the house of David will come, and all of a sudden the bones will come to life, and there will be muscle on them and sinew, and they will come back to life, and together they will return to the land of Israel. And so this preface is really Luther's exegesis on that passage in Ezekiel, and why it doesn't really say what most Jews think that it says. Most Jews think that it means that this will lead to the future inauguration of the Messianic Age. Ezekiel wrote in exile, during the Babylonian exile, and this vision of the resurrection of the people. It's one of national resurrection. Ezekiel isn't talking about individual resurrection. He tells us that in the text itself. That this vision of the Messianic Age coming while they were in exile, and the reason why their bones are dry is because, as Ezekiel tells us, outside of the land of Israel, these people can't be fully alive. They're dead. So the resurrection is the return of the people to the land of Israel. So in a way, it's a perfect text for Martin Luther, because it has to do with Jews being in exile, Jews suffering, and the coming of the Messiah.
What language was he reading the Old Testament in?
I think he read some of it in Hebrew. I think he did read a lot of it in Latin. And I don't know if there were German translations before him that he would have looked at. But he was a monk, so he could do the language study himself, which helped. Okay,
the hope of the Jews that there shall yet be another physical return, when all of them together shall come back into the land and set up again the old Mosaic order of things, this is something they have dreamed of themselves. There is not a letter in the prophets or in Scripture which says or signifies anything of the kind. It is written indeed that they shall return out of all lands whither they have been driven. Not all of them, however, but only some of them out of all lands. There is great difference between a return of all Jews and a return out of all lands. The return out of all lands is fulfilled, and return of all Jews was never prophesied. The Jews neither see nor heed that God promises to create something new in the land, to make a new covenant unlike the old covenant of Moses that they dream about. This is a plan from Jeremiah 31 and from many more passages. No longer are there to be two kingdoms, but one kingdom under their King David who is to come, and his shall be an everlasting kingdom even in that same physical land. This too has been fulfilled. For when Christ came and found the people, both Israel and Judah, gathered again out of all lands, so that the country was full, he started something new. He established the promised new covenant. And although the Jews did not want this covenant, or at least not many of them would accept it, it has nevertheless remained an everlasting covenant, and not only at Jerusalem and in that land. Christ is and remains Lord over all. The Jews want to have a Messiah according to the Old Covenant and pay no attention to this New Covenant. So they miss both covenants and hang between heaven and earth. The New Covenant they do not want, the old they cannot have. Therefore, the scriptures are sealed against them.
Yeah. It's beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful.
Right? So they can't have the Old Covenant because the Old Covenant doesn't exist anymore. Right? That God has now made a New Covenant. But they don't want that New Covenant. So they're really dooming themselves according to this truth. Right? They could be saved, but they're stubborn and hard-hearted and they don't want to be saved. And she really does, I think, a very clever exegesis of Ezekiel, whereas Ezekiel is talking about, you know, he's talking in a certain place and time, and so looking at what Ezekiel's saying very cleverly, Luther is able to say, where is it, that they shall return out of all lands where they've been driven, not all of them, however, but only some of them, so that when Ezekiel is talking, he's talking to the Jews who are in exile in Babylonia. And they will be resurrected as a nation and go back to the land of Israel. That's all he's really saying here. And he's saying that what happens is that in the days of Jesus, you basically have the two kingdoms of Israel that were already reunited, which is part of the Messianic dream. So he's saying the Messianic age was here, the Messianic age is here, but the Jews don't want any part of it. And now we're going to get to... this is a very long treatise. So even just excerpting into this very long paragraph and having all these dot-dot-dots was not easy. This is an essay, again, called On the Jews and Their Lies. You can easily find the entire thing online. So, Ellen?
What shall we Christians do with this rejected and condemned people, the Jews? Since they live among us, we dare not tolerate their conduct now that we are aware of their lying and reviling and blaspheming. If we do, we become sharers in their lies, cursing and blaspheming. Thus we cannot extinguish the unquenchable fire of divine wrath of which the prophets speak, nor can we convert the Jews. With prayer and the fear of God, we must practice a sharp mercy to see whether we might save at least a few of the glowing flames. We dare not avenge ourselves. Vengeance, a thousand times worse than we could wish them already, has them by the throat. I shall give you my sincere advice. First, to set fire to their synagogues or schools, and to bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. This is to be done in honor of our Lord and of Christendom, so that God might see that we are Christians and do not condone or knowingly tolerate such public lying, cursing, and blaspheming of his Son and of his Christians. I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed, for they pursue in them the same aims as in their synagogues. Instead, they might be lodged under a roof or in a barn like the gypsies. I advise that all their prayer books and Talmudic writings in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught be taken from them. I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to death henceforth on pain of loss of life and limb. Fifth, I advise that safe conduct on the highway be abolished completely for the Jews. Let them stay at home. I advise that usury be prohibited to them, and that all cash and treasure of silver and gold be taken from them. I recommend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a distaff, or a spindle into the hands of young, strong Jews and Jewesses, and letting them earn their bread in the sweat of their brow. We cannot help it that they do not share our belief. It is impossible to force anyone to believe. However, we must avoid confirming them in their wanton lying, slandering, cursing, and defaming. Nor dare we make ourselves partners in their devilish ranting and ravings by shielding and protecting them. We cannot acquiesce in having the Jews revile and curse the New Testament in our hearing. To witness this and keep silent is tantamount to doing it ourselves. Thus, the accursed Jews encumber us with their diabolical, blasphemous, and horrible sins in our own country.
Yeah. And that's what I said, this is the document in particular that Lutherans have been wrestling with, and we're wrestling with during 2017, because she can't say, well, this is just, you know, a late Luther. He's totally lucid in this essay, and what he's suggesting are really some really horrible things. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's something a little bit related from your earlier point here, because it's very important to me. Even though I seem to kind of take the heat out, it's terrible, yeah, you know, here. This particular episode of Poland was far from isolated. The lot of Jews after the Second World War was just like that of Afro-Americans after the Civil War. People blamed them for the war. Many who attempted to return to their homes in Poland now were occupied or destroyed. Polish partisans attacked people that had been hiding them. And in fact, this particular blood libel claim did like, this is actually a slap fight compared to what's really done to them across not many villages of Poland. And I'm an indictment of all Poles because they're not unique. Germans, French people who are trying to hide the fact that they themselves have collaborated with Artisan all across much of Europe. The very important point is reminding those who insist on saying this, go back to Poland, go back to Germany, reminding them that they made it very clear, not optional. They decided to fact our country itself closes doors, and the British tried to open their doors to a few of them. Europeans consciously, deliberately sent them on a collision course with the Arab population, and to this day they continue to fight proxy wars through them. They're consciously aware of that. I'm saying this because it's not the dismissed or ignored. Sorry, so you do that.
Thank you,
Donna.
Yeah.
And it's good we have a third session because how this is playing out in the modern period, right. I mean, in the contemporary present period,
very
will
good.
Be Ellen's third session.
Right.
So hold those issues for next week.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I think what's different, though, about what Luther's saying here, and what really makes my blood curl, is when he says that we should do all of this. You know, we should burn their schools and their synagogues and get rid of their prayer books and blah, blah, blah. This is to be done in honor of our Lord and of Christendom so that God might see that we are Christians and do not condone or knowingly tolerate such public lying, cursing, and blaspheming of his Son and of his Christians. I mean, what I would have wanted Luther to say is we are Christians and therefore we are merciful and we are forgiving and, you know, but that's not his idea of what it means to be a Christian. And that's the part that I think Lutherans are really wrestling with today. First of all, that isn't the Martin Luther they're taught. Right? I think most Lutherans will tell you Luther did believe that God is compassionate and loving and merciful, right? And the Christian should act that way. I mean, don't forget they're Protestants. So they believe strongly in what Protestants call the discipleship of Christ, that to be a Christian merely means that you act as Jesus would have acted. And for most Christians, that means to be loving and compassionate, to love your neighbor as yourself. But here you have Luther saying, no, to be a Christian is to make sure that blasphemers of God no longer live. And of course he doesn't renounce any of this before he dies. And had he lived longer, I don't think there's any indication he would have renounced this. Had he continued to live. Yeah.
Is there any sense, even in modern theology or in the Middle Ages, that by trying, not by necessarily destroying Jews, but by overtly trying to convert them and bring them into the fold, that you are expressing God's love?
Oh, yes.
In that sense. And I say that only because 50 years ago, my Wisconsin Synod Lutheran real group aid at the university would leave tracts in the today, you know, again, and would say, well, this is because I love you. And I'm wondering if that's official theological interpretation or just her, you know, sentence.
No, I think that is. I think that's why you would want to convert non-Jews to Christianity, so that they might be saved. Because if they don't become Christians, their soul is really in jeopardy. And chances are they will not be saved. But this whole idea of then turning and saying, okay, so you're not open to conversion, therefore you are blaspheming, lying, slandering, on and on and on. You know, that's why there have been so many psychological studies that have been done of Luther. And if we look, let's just look at the last one. I just added a few sentences. So basically, right after Luther published On the Jews and Their Lies, he told everyone that he was going to write a follow-up treatise. And in fact, he did, and he published it that year. So this is kind of seen as the companion piece on the Jews in their lives. It's called On the Ineffable Name and on the Lineage of Christ. And Ellen just agreed to this.
Just as we must teach and write about the devil, hell, death, and sin, what they are and do, not so that we can turn the devil into an angel, hell into heaven, death into life, sin into holiness, all of which is impossible, but rather so that we will be aware of them, so I write about the Jews. For a Jew or Jewish heart is as hard as wood, as hard as stone, as hard as iron, as hard as the devil, so that it can in no way be moved. They are devil's children, damned to hell.
Yeah, pretty strong.
Barbara, I have a question. During this time, were there any groups of people, Christians, rising up as a group and saying, no, this is not right, this is not the way we want to feel towards Jews? Was there ever anything like that going on?
And then we'll have to end with that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have an answer to that right
now. Yeah. Probably not.
Yeah. Is there any other questions? Are there any other questions in this?
Oh, okay. My big question is, you said before that he was lucid.
Yeah.
I think he... When I was listening to this being read, number 3, their dues on their lives, it felt like he was really losing it.
I don't think he was. That's what's so scary about it. You know, I mean, I don't think we can just write it off to the rantings of a person who is going to die in a few years. I think he really meant what he said. He was inside of Martin Luther. That's scary. I really have to say that he was not a warm, fuzzy person. I don't think anybody would say that. You know, and maybe revolutionaries can't afford to be warm and fuzzy. You know, he really was a revolutionary. And in the end, it's because of Martin Luther, really, that there's no one way to be a Christian today. He really broke open this whole idea of Christian denominationalism. I mean, his challenge to the Pope was one that was taken seriously and that led to all sorts of Protestant denominations in his day and has led to the proliferation of Christian denominations today. I believe that the last time I checked, there are over 350 Protestant denominations in the United States alone. Yeah. Now, the Roman Catholic Church might not see all of them as genuinely Christian or genuinely Protestant, and I know this from teaching at Fairfield University for so many years. But to those adherents themselves, they do see themselves as Protestant. They do see themselves as authentically Christian. But you really have the proliferation of denominations, and that really begins because of Martin Luther. Yeah, George?
I can't help but recognize the parallel of Luther speaking to his base as the president speaks to his base, which is immovable, but if the base already existed, and Luther in his sensitivity sensed this and saw a wonderful way to get that base active, because that anti-Jew feeling still existed all the way in Turkey, but he saw it and he capitalized it and he was elected president.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Wait, this will be a last question. I need a few minutes before services.
Oh, okay.
So I'm just wondering whether or not the other Protestant denominations that rose up, and he was aware of them, did that bother him as well, because they weren't specifically following him and what became becoming Lutherans. So was he upset with the Calvinists, and was he upset with the Methodism you had been at the time?
Yeah.
So did that bother him as much
as the
Jews not following things the way he wanted?
Yeah, I really don't know. I thought that he maintained respect for Calvin, because Calvinism is also pretty conservative. As a Protestant denomination goes, you know what I mean? And similarly with John Wesley, the Methodists. I mean, I wouldn't call them left-wing Protestants, certainly not in Europe. So I really don't know, and I don't know if anyone's actually written about that, but that would be a good topic, because Luther really strikes me as so intolerant. You know, and it's hard to read any essay by Luther in which he really is
a more embracing, warm, which is why what for me, I mean, the psychological biographies I've read on him, all of which are written by men, don't emphasize what a wonderful marriage he had. I mean, here, you know, he's a monk for all these years of his adulthood, and it was one of the things he hated about Catholicism the most. But he and his wife had a long and, by all accounts, happy marriage. He really loved her and was kind to her and their children. And so I don't know how that fits in with this other preacher side of Martin Luther. And that would be something worth looking into. I just wanted to end with a quote. It's not going to make us feel any better about Luther. But this is from a fairly recent biography of Martin Luther by a scholar by the name of Richard Marius, where he comments on the perception of a number of 20th century thinkers that the Nazi pathology really can be traced directly back to Martin Luther. And this is what Marius writes. He writes, this is the quote, "Although the Jews for Luther were only one among many enemies he castigated with equal fervor, although he did not sink to the horrors of the Spanish Inquisition against Jews, and although he was certainly not to blame for Adolf Hitler, Luther's hatred of the Jews is a sad and dishonorable part of his legacy. And it is not a fringe issue. It lay at the center of his concept of religion. He saw in the Jews a continuing moral depravity he did not see in Catholics. He did not accuse papists of the crimes that he laid at the feet of the Jews." Or, as James Carroll in Constantine's Sword then continues, "As the cross replaced the face of Christ as a central Christian icon, with death at the apex of theology and cult, the vulnerability of Jews as the ones responsible for death was axiomatic. Ironically, because suffering and death have been cast as the primary meaning of the life of Christ, in fact, the source of Christian salvation, the suffering of Christians became glorified as the imitation of Christ, while the suffering of Jews continued to be the proof of their sin in Christ's rejection." Well, we're going to pick up back on this next week, but we're going to primarily focus on evangelical Zionists, evangelical Protestants who see themselves as supporting and do support Israel, and also now are giving money to Jews in other countries where they're being persecuted as Jews, and what that's all about theologically. All right, so this won't be a political discussion as much as a theological discussion about what is leading thousands and thousands of evangelical Christians to, in some cases, on the surface at least, be better friends to Israel than many American Jews. And there is a theological agenda behind that, and we'll talk about that next week, and maybe at the end we can say some words
and
about Lutheranism.
Like that. So bear with us just for a moment. First of all, anticipation next week. And Ellen said this is going to be theological, not political. In the same way that exegesis and eisegesis blend, theology is personal. And of course, and the personal is political. So there's no way in a culty, I think, culty society to separate those things. So how they are brought to bear on each other will also be very interesting for us. This is so timely, and this was Ellen's suggestion a year ago. It is so timely and so important and so wonderful. And once again, we thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is having a fundraising this month. If anyone would like to make a contribution, I would appreciate it. You can see me.
Good. Send me an email. I'd like to make a contribution. Two quickies.